live here in this country. Harping on wars, be fighting, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, lots of exciting things happening. I've just completed Friday a six-day, six-city speaking tour of Canada, which took me to my hometown of Hamilton, of course, to Regina, Calgary, Edmonton, and two talks in Vancouver. And every place along the way, I met really interesting people, new people coming out. It's really an exciting time. Yesterday was the Friday was the strike for climate change. Blah blah blah. Students out on the streets in many Canadian cities, including Vancouver, where there were perhaps about 15,000 people who were in the City Hall area, and they were striking for climate change, at least the students were. I get a laugh out of this. A strike is a term, and it's the withholding of services in an economic setting. So it's a labor dispute. And in a strike, the workers withhold their labor or go on strike in the hopes of negotiating better conditions. That's the simple definition of it. So how is it that students playing hockey, not going to school that day, is a strike? Well, they're not withholding their services. They're actually damaging their own education. And, you know, we have to ruthlessly call these people on this nonsense. And that's what it is. Well, in Vancouver, kind of a bad thing happened. Citizen videographer Brian Rue, who's now produced over 2,000 videos. One of his tactics these days is to go out into the street, public areas, usually with a sign that will provoke thought and discussion. And seek people's reaction. And he had one of his signs was that this whole climate change thing was a hoax. That people are worrying themselves sick over nothing. Let me see, I want to be absolutely accurate about this. He said on his sign, climate change is a hoax. And you got people discussing this, and people discussed it, and he videoed this. When he was up on the Cambie Street Bridge, which is a major bridge in downtown Vancouver near City Hall, he was attacked by three members of Antifa. One of them had a mask on. They tried to rip away his sign, and they did, and they knocked his video camera off a tripod, and then picked it up and flung it over the Cambie Street Bridge, and it smashed on the ground below. So he's out a video camera. That's the bad news. The good news is that one of his assistants videoed the whole incident, and that will be up on the internet quite soon. He's going to be talking to the Vancouver police tomorrow. This is very typical of the violent Antifa behavior in Canada. Out to suppress those people, to beat those people up who disagree with them. And they're aggressive. Now, yesterday, to his credit, Conservative Party leader Andrew Scheer did not participate in any of the public marches for climate strike day. And as I say, very, very much to his credit. And neither, of course, did Maxime Bernier. Maxime Bernier knows quite well and was prepared to say that basically the man-caused climate change hysteria is a hoax. Not that climate isn't changing, but having said that it's changing, you haven't said anything. Climate's always changing. We are being stampeded into a hoax, and I think it can't be repeated often enough. Climate changes all the time. When there are more sunspots or explosions on the sun, it gets warmer. When there are fewer, it gets colder. Climate change may be something we may have to adapt to as we see the direction it's changing into. If it's getting warmer, we may have to do one thing. If it's getting cooler, we may have to do a different thing. That's not to say we may not have to adapt, of course, but we always have. One of the many results of the catastrophic crop damage during the Great Depression, when much of North America became incredibly dry, and there were dust storms that blew away a lot of the topsoil, that brought about an adaptation in farming methods, including, among other things, the development of hardier species of grain. We will have to adapt as we see in which direction the change is moving, but to basically shut down our industrial economies, to ban the use or eventually get away from the use of fossil fuels like coal for electrical generating stations when necessary, or gasoline to power cars, or diesel or natural gas to heat our homes, if other alternatives cheaper alternatives become available, of course, move in that direction. But to shut ourselves down because of that, that's insanity. And that was some of the hysteria we saw today. I was talking to a good supporter and backer earlier today, and we were happy that the minority of people who are being driven almost hysterical by this, by the fear-mongering about climate change, have fortunately three parties to divide their votes among in Canada, and people who are sensible about the causes of climate change, and knowing that we have nothing to do with it, have two to choose from: the Conservative Party of Canada and Maxime Bernier's Rebel Party. Here's a very interesting, I think I can play it for you, very interesting commentary by a girl who, I think we can play this, it's called Greta, and this is by Sylvie. I'm sorry, Sof.
Greta Thunberg, my arch nemesis and fellow
I hope we're not going to have too much trouble with this audio.
Despite the political disparities, I like what you do. Fostering panic, making people anxious, inching all of us closer and closer to a Franz Ferdinand assassination-style event to kick off the next major war. I like you better if you didn't bitch out and start crying in the middle of your speeches, but that's besides the point. I admire you for being a child and rhetorically outdoing professional politicians on divisive issues. It really shows how it only takes one strongly opinionated shithead to completely destabilize democracy, and I like that. You have a lot of balls for a Swede. Don't get me wrong, though, you still are a shithead, and the politics you promote are premium unleaded autism. For example, one thing Thunberg harps on about is countries like China and India signing the Paris Agreement, which I personally find hilarious. The Chinese have golden statues of Chairman Mao. His face is still on their money. What in the world makes you think they care about this planet in the slightest? I'm gonna let you in on a little secret, Greta. They put a camel through the eye of a needle before you make a Chinaman go against his interests. As for Indians, there's a joke somewhere here about gas emission that I can't be bothered to make. Just know that one time a guy tried paying people to use the bathroom and he got beaten to death. That's just about all you need to know. And even if, by some miracle, you managed to complete the Sisyphean task of wrangling billions of Khajiits and Orientals into giving an iota of a fisherman's fuck about this world, it wouldn't do you any favors. All it would do is massively constipate every country's economy, especially third world ones who can't afford sanitation, let alone fucking solar panels.
Strange how signing the Paris Accord will purportedly provide.
On top of that, the $75 billion getting funneled into this issue won't put a dent in it anyway. The Earth has been warming for the past 420,000 years without any human inventions farting out carbon. Turns out there's no amount of policy writing and protesting that can reverse nature. Go figure. Additionally, why do we keep subsidizing the delusions of grandeur of scientists who think they can predict the future? I know it's become virtually blasphemous to question a scientific consensus, but it baffles me how conjecture becomes prophecy the moment someone in a lab coat says it. Apparently, the more experienced an expert is, the less accurate his predictions become. Scientists can't help but be monomaniacal about their field of study, which makes them less likely to account for variables. These people have had intense tunnel vision on the same piece of molecular lint for the past 20 years. They're the last people to get future predictions from. In the 60s, there was a culturally relevant prediction that hundreds of millions would die from starvation by the 1980s due to overpopulation. And guess what? Didn't fucking happen. People have been proclaiming our demise is just 10 years away for the past 100. You might as well be reading schizo posts on X. On the other hand, this whole talk of incoming climate catastrophe is a mighty convenient cover-up for the oil peak situation coming our way, as demonstrated by the graph. Another convenient thing is how behind every Bill Nye and Al Gore, there's a dozen government officials and corporate figures with huge incentives to regulate the shit out of energy. That's because science is an especially effective tool for raping the populace's pockets. Just present the layman with some graphs and you can convince him that it's necessary to give up his earnings to save us all from apocalypse. That's why governments love guiding the scientific autism towards envisioning the chrono-trigger bad end screen globally. With people in fear and the alternatives regulated out of existence, the few energy sources left get an eternal carte blanche for incompetence because there are no other options. Stunts like these are pulled all the time. In fact, Every one of 73 UN prediction models way overshot future atmospheric warming. This also serves to quench the secular boner for a carbon tax. And mark my words, soon enough we're going to need a fucking breathing license. But of course, all this legal empowerment is just to stop capitalist swine from ruining the environment. The genius of the climate change crisis is that it's worldwide, meaning globalized policymaking, also known as placing your tender little butt cheeks on a platter before UN politicians, who now get to decide if you, a resident of Alabama, are allowed to use straws. One thing I find particularly interesting is that models that predict less extreme climate change get completely swept under the rug, which bodes very well with Greta's message.
Adults keep saying, we owe it to the young people to give them hope. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act.
Without about an actual issue, I'd get the message. There's no diversionary tactic more insidious than the Western illusion of safety. If I had the opportunity to speak to a room full of paid-off Power Rangers putties, I'd probably say something along those lines. But the underlying narrative here is just making a buck off of the doomer message, which I don't support. There's no upside to doom parroting when the issue you're tackling is Ozone Galactus swallowing the Earth whole. What pisses me off even more is that people like Thunberg and Cortez get framed as radicals just because the solution they propose are episodes of Bugs Bunny. Being a moron doesn't make you radical, especially when the people who back you up are worth millions. If climate change is as threatening as it's made out to be, the last thing you should do is reaffirm the politicians who are standing in the way of fixing it by getting all weepy and begging on your knees for policy changes. School strikes are for the fucking birds. If you really want some change, get yourself an assault rifle and in addition to my hypothesis of climate change being real, ask yourself this. Should we even try to stop it? Because I find it strangely coincidental how New York and California, the bluest and most degenerate states who are the biggest fans of taxing everyone to smithereens, will be underwater if the caps melt. Doesn't it sound like a godsend flood to you? Beyond all of that, I want to take a moment to appreciate the media coverage of the Greta Thunberg phenomenon. While she has received a little bit of media flack, the overwhelming majority of the online attention directed towards her is positive. It's not difficult to notice this media double standard that either praises or demonizes children based on their views. The contrast between the way the media treats Greta and I is very telling. Not once has any major publication gotten away with calling Greta brainwashed, puppeteered, or just trying to rebel. Is it because of that two-year difference? Or is it because her views fall safely in that bubble of insanity that is socially acceptable? Greta, if you're watching, we're not that different, you and I. I wish for politicians to feel fear as well, just not for the same reasons. Getting thousands of kids...
That's Soph. She's 14 years old, extremely articulate, a little bit foul-mouthed occasionally at times, but she really tore a strip off Greta Thunberg, and I really like that. This is some really good common sense. Well, I'll be back with you in just a minute. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. We have an extremely interesting write-up by, excuse me, a prolific author here in British Columbia, and his name is Tim Murray, and this is called The Great Replacement in 30 Seconds. There's a 30-second commercial that's been filling the TV screens for a week now. Elections Canada encourages Canadians to register and vote on October 21st because, in their words, it's our vote. But if you look at the faces of the half dozen people featured in this ad, you might get the impression that it is not our vote. That's the vote of old stock Canadians, or as they say in Quebec, Québécois de souche. But their vote, the vote of the million migrants who pass through our gates or walk across our borders each and every year, courtesy of an immigration and refugee policy constructed in defiance of public opinion. As far as I can determine, at least four of the actors in this cute story are people of color, and three of them new Canadians, including one or two-year-old product of a biracial marriage. Even the less discerning of us will appreciate that Elections Canada's sales pitch is rife with stark symbolism. If it needed a title, it could be called Moving Day, as it features someone whom I would dub Mr. Tolkien, a young white male with golden locks, cheerfully helping POP, that's people of color, carry furniture into their new abode. Significantly, several frames depict the new Canadians among them as a citizenship ceremony, with their right hand up and poised to swear allegiance. Particularly poignant is the image of the baby boy in his father's arms clutching a small maple leaf flag. All in all, it is one big, happy, and harmonious display of Canada in the making. Aside from their racial composition, one cannot fail to notice that all of the people in this ad are young. It doesn't take a genius to see what demographic this commercial is directed at, and which political parties or politicians they're most likely to vote for. Let me give you a hint. It isn't Maxime Bernier or the People's Party of Canada. Of course, I wouldn't dream of questioning the neutrality of the taxpayer-funded instrument of information and integrity like Elections Canada. I'm sure that Elections Canada is above reproach, like the CBC. Diversity cultists would no doubt claim that the racial makeup of these actors merely represents the reality of Canada today. Well, not quite. Visible minorities make up roughly half of Metro Vancouver and Metro Toronto, not two-thirds, as this ad would suggest. Moreover, in no way does this ad reflect the racial profile of the nation at large, where visible minorities make up 22% of the population. It may come as a shock to the social engineers in Ottawa, Toronto, and Vancouver, but the universe extends beyond the urban boundaries of these bastions of enlightenment, tolerance, and diversity. As a matter of fact, I would suggest that a good third of Canadians are grounded in reality, something that most progressive big city dwellers can barely relate to. If these morally superior beings were interested in seeing what reality looks like, the protocol is clear. Turn off the CBC, pack your bags, get in your car, and take a trip to a small town hinterland communities where ordinary people tend to dwell. But be prepared to be triggered by common sense. It must be understood that in commissioning commercials like this, it was never the intention of the immigration lobby and its executive arm in Parliament to depict Canada as it actually is, but rather to condition viewers to accept the Canada that they hope will unfold. The message is, this is the done deal. This is what our cities and towns will soon look like, whether you like it or not. Resistance is futile. In other words, these kind of TV ads are not descriptive, but prescriptive. And we have a ton of them in recent years, haven't we? Those who care to reflect upon the rapid demographic change that this Elections Canada message illustrates will soon realize that it's not precisely about moving day, but rather moving in day. But if someone is moving in, then the question becomes, who's moving out? From coast to coast, the answer is clear. Old stock Canadians, both young and old, that's why formerly sleepy towns and quiet havens from Camrose to Charlottetown are experiencing a population boom. The irony is that many of these white flight or white plight urban refugees are fleeing from the consequences of policies imposed by the open borders policies they voted for. Maybe we should call it the California liberal effect. Displacement looks good on them, doesn't it? Do you think that eventually these people will connect the dots between urban decay, unaffordable housing, and traffic congestion on the one hand, and the policy of mass immigration on the other? Can we fix stupid? Time will tell. And Tim Murray actually makes an extremely good point here. And this is an observation that's being made by people like my friend Stan Hess in Idaho, and places like Idaho and Colorado are a magnet for some of the white flight from California. But the funny thing is, and this is the somewhat depressing thing, some of the people fleeing from California haven't learned a lesson. They come to places like Idaho or Montana and still bring their left liberal policies. In other words, the very policies, mass immigration, that that made California or much of California unlivable for white people, are the same policies that they want to push in their new location. In other words, what the policies that drove them out of their original homes in California are the very policies that they would now like to support. It in many ways is quite mentally dysfunctional. One of the things I like about Tim Murray's little critique there, excuse me, is that it helps explain and nail down why it is, or actually what it is that's happening to us, and that's important. It's important to understand the mechanism, or the manipulation. And so much advertising, but you know, the interracial couples and so on, and ads that are chock-a-block with third worlders, or if you turn on the CBC, especially on the weekend, you need a search warrant to find a white announcer. There's a Chinese anchor relating to, I don't know, usually some sort of black reporter or Arab reporter. And if you were just in from, let's say, Switzerland, and you didn't know too much about Canada, and you turned on the television, you would think that basically Canada's the third world country. Well, that's of course what the goal is, but we're not there yet. And I think it remains for all of us to persistently call these people out, you know, complaining. I know as white people, we've been taught not to complain. You know, you kind of get on with it with good, practical European common sense. You adapt to the new situation, you grin and bear it, you do your job, and so on. And in normal times and circumstances, that's a good approach. We don't like to be a nation of whiners and complainers and professional victims. But in the situation in which we find ourselves, that's what we need to be to protect ourselves. I'd like to give you an example of big institutions like to grind us down. I'll digress for just a minute. When I left Ontario 5 days ago, gasoline was $1.17 a liter, at least in and around Toronto, give or take a few cents. In American terms, that would be about $4.60, give or take, a gallon, which is even the most heavily taxed American states, is outrageous. Yes, because our governments just suck us dry through taxes. Okay, $1.17 a liter in Ontario. When I got out to Alberta, which is a huge oil-producing province, of course, gasoline was about 97 cents a liter around the airport. And that would be probably a more expensive venue. But you know, let's take that, about 97 cents. When I got to Vancouver, gasoline was $1.37. And then, Friday, I noticed it had risen to $1.57 or $1.59 a liter. You know, in American terms, that's over $6 a gallon. And I wonder, well, first of all, why is British Columbia so high? Well, there are several reasons. One is that they have these insane extra taxes on gasoline. All provinces tax gasoline. But in British Columbia, they have a carbon tax, so that punishes the motorists further. But then you've got, I believe, collusion by the oil companies. Why is it that Vancouver is 20 cents a liter more expensive than 250 miles away in the Okanagan Valley? Furthermore, why Thursday night does gasoline go up 20 cents a liter? That's like 80 cents a gallon in Vancouver. The weekend's coming and more people travel? That's got to be it. So you've got this immoral combination of high taxation, carbon tax, and corporate greed. And I've brought this up to motorists on a number of occasions. And, you know, quite often they'll completely agree with me. Oh, yes, it's terrible. But the next challenge is, well, why don't you fight back? And some, of course, we really don't know how to fight back. It will take mass citizens' action to wean the oil companies of their greed, but also to wean oil companies, to wean government of their greed. Here's a comment by one of the key members of cultural Marxism, an Italian communist theoretician from the 1920s and 30s, Antonio Gramsci. Socialism is precisely the religion that must overwhelm Christianity in the new order. Socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of the schools, universities, churches, and media, by transforming the consciousness of society. And in very large measure, this is what has happened, or what Gramsci called the long march through the institutions. Radicals get in on the ground level. And as many of the people of my generation who were hippies and extremists back in the, you know, in the late 60s, very early 70s, they began to follow this, cut their long hair, conform at least a little outwardly, and infiltrate. Now that's in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, by the late 80s and 90s, they were the managers. They were the elite of the institutions, or the new establishment. Some, of course, had changed their ideas along the way, but many had not. And that's why many of our universities today are so intolerantly far left. It's not just the well-programmed, conditioned young radicals, but it's the administrations that, far from fighting them, support them. And that was one of the things I found when I was an opponent of student radicalism when I was at the University of Toronto. I would have thought, you know, as a young, relatively naive person, that the university administrators would be on my side, eager to have a conservative young person. I would have thought that the people like me and others would be welcomed. But no, they saw us, not the campus radicals who were occupying administration offices and so on. They saw us as the bad people, not the student radicals. And that became a big insight, and I've never forgotten that the radicalization of our society is being accomplished by radicals, often under false pretenses, infiltrating our institutions. Well, I mentioned an article several days ago by an Evan Balgord, who is a freedom speech hating individual. He's the executive chairman, or you know, the chief cook and bottle washer of an anti-free speech organization in Ottawa called the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. Well, Evan Balgort had an article in the Hamilton Spectator urging the local community college the local community college, Mohawk College, to cancel an engagement by People's Party of Canada leader Maxime Bernier tomorrow night, Sunday night, where he would be talking about party policy and rallying supporters in the various Hamilton ridings. And Balgort, trotted out the usual defamations that the party was right-wing, not inclusive, blah, 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 blah. And frankly, it, in my opinion, it shouldn't matter whether they are right-wing, left-wing, no-wing, middle of the road, off the road. Several principles should apply. It's publicly funded institution. All taxpayers, if you're a taxpayer, contribute willingly or otherwise to fund this place. As such, it should be open to any member of the public to book space and to hold a meeting. Evan Balgort's arguments were a bit more extensive than that. But a very interesting and very well-written article appeared in Rebuttal today, and it was written by a man whom I mentioned before, named Salim Mansour. And Salim Mansour is a Muslim, although he's not well liked by radical jihadi Muslims, or as he calls them, Islamists. And he responds to the suggestion that the People's Party of Canada is racist. Now, this is a really well-written and well-argued article. I'm a People's Party of Canada candidate, and I'm not a racist. I'm a member of the People's Party. In fact, I am likely more evil than most. You see, I worked on the People's Party of Canada's immigration policy, and I am a People's Party of Canada candidate in London North Centre. This is Salim Mansour. On Wednesday, an op-ed appeared in the Spectator, so in the Spectator's opinion section, written by Evan Balgort, executive director of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. It called for Mohawk College to cancel an event at which Maxime Bernier, the leader of the People's Party of Canada, and YouTube talk show host David Rubin were to discuss the erosion of freedom of expression in Canada. And believe me, they don't want that discussed. No, they do not. Because, of course, they are among the main culprits. The cultural Marxists who dominate so much of our society today are among the very biggest culprits in restricting free speech. Reacting to Balgort's call to arms, a local group of Antifa activists has vowed to cause mayhem should the event at Mohawk College go ahead on Sunday as planned. Their name, incidentally, is short for anti-fascist, a paradox given their totalitarian behavior. Of course, Balgort's insistence that the free expression rights of a federal party leader be quashed underscores the importance of this topic and the scheduled talk. I'll return to that in a minute. This is Salim Mansour writing. But first, I want to examine the justification Balgort gives for employing the methods of totalitarian regimes. He makes the claim that freedom of speech and freedom of assembly must be quashed because Maxime Bernier and the People's Party promotes racism. Now, my argument, and I believe Mansour's, is even if it were true, that shouldn't prevent you from having a meeting. By this kind of logic, I must be a racist too. This is Salim Mansour writing. I'm a member of the People's Party. In fact, I'm more likely more evil than most. You see, I worked on the People's Party of Canada immigration policy, and I'm a People's Party of Canada candidate in London North Centre. Does this make me a racist? In Val Gord's logic, it does. But the Senate of Canada considered my years of effort in reconciling people of different faiths, especially Jews, Christians, Muslims, and together promote peace, as worthy to award me in 2017 with the Senate Sesquicentennial Medal celebrating the 105th anniversary of the founding of our Dominion. I'm a professor emeritus political science at the University of Western Ontario, where some of my work was dedicated to defending Canada's liberal democratic values of rights and freedoms against those who seek to erode them. You might be interested in, he gives you links. I'm a survivor of genocidal war in Bangladesh, formerly East Pakistan, waged by the Pakistani army and Islamist collaborators who have weaponized my faith tradition for political purposes, causing havoc across the world. I came to Canada as a refugee. I'm a Muslim, and now I see the ideology and people that wrecked my homeland ensconced in my adopted country. They've become embedded in our mainstream political parties, pushing their anti-modern values into the bloodstream of Canadian culture and politics. And he's one of the strongest people in calling out not just globalism, but also Islamism, and which, as he pointed out at Maxime Bernier's unveiling of immigration policy in Mississauga on July 25th of this year, Islamism and globalism are both have no loyalty to any country. They're truly internationalist, and as such, cooperate. And then he goes on to say, yet Val Gord insinuates members and supporters of the People's Party of Canada, including me, are racist. It is a far-left ideology that motivates Val Gord's totalitarian behavior, and it's now promoted in our universities and condoned by many in the mass media. Under this worldview, one must worship at the altar of identity politics. Heretics will be burned at the stake. Increasingly, the threats and violence are becoming more than just figurative. They want to stifle free speech in the name of fighting racism. The irony is the activity of Val Gord and his Antifa supporters are vulgar, un-Canadian, and plainly stated racist, or anti-white. It was the Chinese dissident and prisoner of conscience Li Xiaobo who stated in his 2010 Nobel Prize address that he could not deliver in person because he was in jail. Freedom of expression is the foundation of human rights, the source of humanity, and the mother of truth. To strangle freedom of speech is to trample on human rights, stifle humanity, and suppress truth. Liu Xiaobo died in hospital in 2017 after spending years in Chinese communist prisons and just being released from his latest sentence. If we allow Val Gord and his people to stifle our free speech, we are then headed down fast on a slippery slope toward a state of affairs against which individuals like Liu Xiaobo, Vaclav Havel, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and others have struggled at the risk of their lives. I found freedom in Canada. Val Gord wants to take away that freedom from me on the false argument that allowing the People's Party of Canada to hold a free speech gathering in Canada in Hamilton will stoke racism. I will speak on Sunday night at the event in Hamilton. I will talk about freedom and that without free speech, there is no freedom. Canadians fought and sacrificed twice in the last century, defending freedom and saving Europe from totalitarian serfdom. I'm not sure that was true, but okay. Children of those Canadians who died in Dieppe and Normandy will not be bulldozed into silence by Val Gord and his Antifa thugs. And so, it says here. Salim Mansour is the People's Party of Canada, candidate for London North Centre in the upcoming October 21st federal election. I think this is a very powerful statement. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side. Let me go and take a kind of a truncated musical break tonight. And this is another great Merle Haggard song, Daddy Frank, the Guitar Man, Was Blind. Another one of the great songs by this just recently passed away musical talent and performer.
Daddy Frank played the guitar and the French harp. Sister played the ringing tambourine. And Mama couldn't hear our pretty music. But she read our lips and helped the family sing. That little band was all a part of living. And our only means of living at the time. And it wasn't like no normal family combo. 'Cause Daddy Frank, the guitar man, was blind. Frank and Mama counted on each other. Their one and only weakness made them strong. Mama did the driving for the family. And Frank made a living with a song. Home was just a camp along the highway. Pickup bed was where we bedded down. Don't ever once remember going hungry. But I remember Mama cooking on the ground. Daddy Frank played the guitar. She read our lips and helped the family sing. That little band was all part of living. And our only means of living at the time. And it wasn't like no normal family combo. 'Cause Daddy Frank, the guitar man, was blind. Don't remember how they got acquainted. There had to be some special help from someone. And blessed be the one who let it be. Fever caused my mom's loss of hearing. Daddy Frank was born without his sight. And Mama needed someone she could lean on.
It's Merle Haggard. Here's a song by Hank Jr., Hank Williams Jr., Family Tradition. And family's always meant a lot to Hank Jr. Of course, he's the son of the legendary Hank Williams Sr. Hank Williams Jr., Family Tradition. That's because we are very...
on a few others than me. I guess it's because I kind of changed my direction. Lord, I
Williams Jr. and one of the great ones. Family tradition. Gonna end up this musical interlude with one of the really greats of country and western music.
Here's a guy who speaks well for Cajun country, the Louisiana man himself, Mr. Doug Kershaw.
Well, we're having a little bit of trouble here connecting. These internet problems are sent to plague us. Merle Haggard, Big City. Side of me back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, all those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. I hope. we do have problems here. Where I am up in the mountains, so. With a kind of (laughs)